Welcome to episode 2, The Herstory of Modern Birth. Today, we will be taking a step back in time and a short but deep dive into the history of women and our bodies, and how this has led us to the birthing practices we're in today. We visit the world of goddesses, vulva art, and how women were once revered for their ability to create life. And then move through the times into a world where women were seen as dirty representations of men, whose primary role was to reproduce, and our bodies seen as machines, reflecting the mechanization of the current world. On this whistle-stop tour of history, or should I say her story, you will hear about the godsips. You definitely want to listen to this. The closing off of keyholes during birth, and of course some fun along the way. We'll even get a sneak peek into the vulva art that one of us loves to make. So put on your seatbelt and start your car, get comfy in your seat, or put on the kettle as you get ready for a few minutes with us. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. Rachel, we have some ground to cover here, but I think it's important to start somewhere at the beginning to really get an idea of how we live in the current society we do as women. We wanted to start the podcast with an episode that we could always reflect back on to give a landing point or a point of reference from where most of our current day experiences come from. And really, I want to for us to just talk a bit about, you know, currently where we are in society, but actually this has roots really deep and much further back than, you know, many of us even think about. And it really does reflect on what is happening with birth, with feeding, and with women in society today.
Yeah, well, I think you can't really talk about where we are now without looking historically. So when I look at a topic, I always start with history. So whenever I do, you know, induction or anything like that, what I do, my first search is looking at the historical basis of whatever it is I'm looking at. And I actually started that when I did my Bachelor of Midwifery, was you start right the way back, and that's your starting point. And then the other thing that you always include is the professional standards of today. And those two things go into everything. So,
and these two things I learned from you. So thank you very much, because that improved my practice a lot, because I definitely wasn't the type of midwife who was looking at both ends of the spectrum. But now, as a midwife and lactation consultant, I do exactly that. I want to know where it started, why it started, and what we're looking at now. And then we can look at the frameworks that we're working around. So I think this is, it's a really important point.
Yeah. And if we don't understand how something came about, then how can we change it? If we don't understand what it's built on.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I guess I've got root back into this really deeply, right? Writing the book that I'm writing at the moment, because the first chapter is her story. And then all the way through for each section, I've gone into the her story of rituals and practice around birth, which all just ties in with the history. And, you know, the modern birth practices in the Western world are very much still kind of focused around the 1900s practice, which was underpinned by the what happened before that. So what I suggest anybody does if they want to obviously buy my book and read my chapter, but Jane Hardwick Collins.
Get the plug in there, Rachel, absolutely. She's going to totally hate me for doing this. So of course I'm going to do it. Rachel Reed, in every good bookstore, Why Induction Matters. Find it online or in your own great bookstore. Rachel is also currently writing an epic book, which will also be in great bookstores close to you very shortly. But just for your special ears, listeners, we are going to be discussing around the first chapter. So see it as a bit of a sneak peek into Rachel Reed's new book coming soon.
So what I recommend people do is listen to or read Jane Hardwick Collins' Her Story, which is a really kind of condensed whistle-stop tour through all the really key aspects of change, and do a search for Jane Hardwick Collins' Her Story. We're going to get her on this podcast, but I won't ask her to talk about the same thing again. I have plans. And another thing, Marilyn French has written a series of books if you want to go really, really, really in-depth.
Can you give an example of what type of stuff that Marilyn French is writing about? Because actually, I haven't read anything from Marilyn French, so I need to add that to my book.
She's actually written The History of Women.
So I missed that one.
I missed
the whole History of Women.
You missed it.
All right. Maybe I should do. So I started this podcast and I haven't read about The History of Women. Okay, right. So I'm just going to leave this podcast now to Rachel and call it The Midwife's Cauldron with Dr. Rachel Reed.
Well, to be fair, okay. Marilyn French has done, I think it's 4 volumes. It's full on. I haven't
Christ.
Read them all. Exactly.
So I'm never going to get round to that before the end of the 40th episode of
Don't
this.
Worry. Just read Jane's work and then you can read my chapter and
I
then
have.
You're sorted. Okay. I guess we go all the way back, because the way that we birth is really a reflection of the culture and society we live in, which is why birth practices change across the globe and in different cultures and different societies. What's normal, and even in little microcosms, you know, what was normal in the northeast of England, which was the cultural norm of the way women birthed, yeah, and what they wanted from birth, and how the rituals and the practice around that were very different to over here in Australia, with kind of the kind of women who could afford to pay for a private practice midwife, you know, a different culture in that little microcosm.
Absolutely.
So yeah, we need to bear in mind that this is, you know, very generalized history, and the way that women birth reflects their own culture and their own history.
And it's also how history's been written down. So we can only go with what
yeah, and we've certainly
got.
In terms of written history, that's been men until kind of the 1940s, really, which is when female historians, and then again, it was very much from the Western perspective, the white Western perspective. So there's a lot of history that's missing or is there, but just hasn't been kind of uncovered and put into words. It's being passed down orally. But what we do know is that we've had a massive, there's been kind of major shifts in culture. So yeah, the evidence is that early humans lived in matricentric communities, which is not matriarchal, you know, it wasn't women in charge, but the communities were set up around women and children because that sustained the tribe. And child bearing was obviously a female role because women had the anatomy to do that, but rearing children was a village, you know, it was, and men would care for babies. So it was more of a collective. And it's interesting because if we look at this in modern day, we now know that male partners, actually their hormones alter when women are pregnant and immediately after birth.
Yep.
So, you know, women are not the only people who need to be looking after babies. You know, we haven't evolved to be singularly looking after a baby as a woman. That's not.
Absolutely not at all. And I think that's something that we really forget. And, you know, we hear that old adage, it's a village that raises a child. And it seems like a cliche, but my God, is it true? And I love how we call it a matricentric, not a matriarchal.
Yeah.
Not that you cloned it and invented it. I'm just saying, I think it's a really, you know, it's important that we define the differences between that.
And at that time, you know, the goddesses were female because they created life. So it was obvious that if whoever created humans must have been female, because humans come out of female vaginas. So the early art was, you know, vulvas on caves. And I know, Katie, you still continue that tradition to this day with your, I have one of your golden vulvas.
I have one hanging on my wall. Yes. I mean, if you listen back to our intro podcast, it will tell you how I wanted to be an artist. And I continue that. And it's really strange how when I was 15, all my art was of pregnant women in paper mache or in clay. And then I didn't pick up clay again until about 5 years ago and started to do pottery on the wheel and then went into sculpture. And my sculptures are all goddesses, female heads, female bodies, feminist art, but predominantly there was a, I happened to make one vulva and I glazed it gold. This was quite a joy by many of my friends who then wanted one and placed orders, so to speak. And there are many of my golden vulvas or yonis around the globe. And I brought one with me and I do have a yoni on my wall and I have several that are on my shelves. But I mean, for me, what I was reading or have been reading when the drummers were women or when the women were drummers. See, that's why our podcast, that obviously is where our podcast name came from. But actually, I haven't read that book before I thought about our podcast being called When the Witches Were Midwives or the Midges. When the Midges
were witches.
When the Midges were witches. I read this book. And so for me, I knew, I mean, I've read about the history of goddesses and of course, celebrating birth and to have a god or a spirit or a deity as female makes perfect sense because like you say, we're birthing creation. But I had no idea that really throughout my entire life, I've been creating this type of art. And then I realized, and I had one of those moments where you put the book down and you just let the tingles in your arm be so enjoyable. And I read that the first sculptures 30,000 years ago that they'd found were of vulvas. And I just thought, yes, if I was reincarnated, I was one of those sculptors making vulvas. And that's why I have vulvas now around the globe and some stuck on my walls.
You need...
I will put a picture up on our Instagram.
When I was in Israel a couple of years ago, I went to the Israeli Museum. You need one of your vulvas in there, Katie.
Yeah.
So they've got an amazing collection of artworks that depict the deities from way, way back, like the earliest, you know, really early human artworks. And it's just breasts and vulvas and female images, you know, carved and represented in lots of triangles. And you kind of follow it through the times and then it slowly starts to evolve in more kind of obvious human, but still female. And then it just starts to shift just as the religion shifted. You then had gods alongside female deities and there was men and women depicted. And then you kind of saw the women disappearing and the male gods becoming bigger and then turning into kind of the uni gods, I guess, of modern religions. So the depictions of birth way, way back, the very, very early depictions of birth. And it's difficult to know whether they're, because they're cave paintings, whether they're pictures of women, human women giving birth, or whether these are depictions of Mother Earth or whoever was venerated at the time giving birth. But there's always a huge woman birthing, surrounded by smaller figures. So she's the center of the birth. And that imagery carries on all the way through history, where birth is depicted as a woman birthing, who is the center of the picture, supported and surrounded usually by two women, actually, in an upright position. In terms of knowing how our ancestors birthed, it's kind of difficult because our female ancestors didn't record that in writing. But the pictures tell us the story that birth was something that was active and upright and supported by other women throughout history.
So if we take this as a standing point and we come forward into the bit of the more recent history where we see that, you know, there was a uni-god and there was, you know, a segmentation of religions and depending on where you lived in the world. And can you just tell us a little bit more about how that impacted on the medicalization of birth and also in terms of the upholding and the standing of men within society and how that impacted on men that were able to be the ones who became the scientists, so to speak, and then became the surgeons and this type of history and how that's changed for us as women?
Well, you can probably blame agriculture for everything. So when agriculture came about, we then had the need for humans to own land. And then if you're going to own land, you need to own children to work the land. So we had a different configuration of societies. And that really brought in the stratification of people. Because if I've got more land than you, I'm now more powerful than you. And in terms of, and we still have stratifications now of, you know, sex, race, all these divisions where we stratify some people as better than others. That's still here. And that kind of really kicked in at that point. And generally speaking, males are bigger and stronger than women. So they fought the fights. They invaded other men's lands. So real, you know, physical prowess became really important. And also we needed more children to replace the men who had been killed by the wars. So women's capacity to reproduce and the fact that that was something they were doing, it shifted from them doing that and the and society raising the children to actually that was women's primary role. And it needed to be to sustain the patriarchy that was rising out of the need to own land. So we had women who were defined by their role to reproduce, and that became their role. So as a woman, that is your job. So they were being erased from any other roles in status other than their role as a mother. And we can see that in the development of religions, because the male gods became more important than the female gods. And the role of women in religion shifted. So, you know, the Catholics realized there's this whole war over trying, you know, people holding on to their goddesses, you know, in the Sheila Nagigs and all the things, you know, the pagans refusing to give up their idol worship and their goddess worship. And that was across everywhere. You know, the people carried on worshipping goddesses. And the evolving churches, and, you know, I'll talk more about kind of the Christian Catholic, because that was the kind of European influence, and they influenced the medicalization of childbirth far more than other religions. So, you know, you had the Protestants and the Catholics over in Europe going, well, you know, these people will not stop worshipping their goddesses. So they had to give them things in place of that. And
these stubborn old women.
Yeah. And, you know, women were
so terrible that we won't stop worshipping the women that birth, the women that give us some, you know, oh, we've had everything taken away from us. No worries. You go ahead. Thank God there were some stubborn women. They're the ones that still are fighting now. They're our ancestors.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
Yeah. So for example, the three fates were would attend births in Europe, and the midwives and the gossips would put out kind of, you know, goodies for the three fates so that they would spin and weave a good fate for the baby. And that was really frowned on.
Can you just explain a little bit what a fate is, or what a gossip is, to anyone who might not know? Because I really love how they're described. And, you know, we see this in really a modern day in society, in with our girlfriends and with the people that, you know, we love and who support us now.
There were three. Well, they're called the three sisters or the three fates, depending. And they were just three kind of supernatural figures, I guess. Deities turn up at a birth in order to spin a fate or declare a destiny on the child. You know, midwives and gossips were carrying on that tradition in the Middle Ages and were very much frowned on by the church for doing so. But this last kind of hold, I guess, of the collective culture of women in birth, and which is what Adrienne Wilson wrote about, this was the kind of last hold before medicalization really kicked in. And this was like, so we're talking about Europe here, and really the European approach to birth was exported as, you know, Europe colonized the world and spread their fantastic way of doing things across the globe.
Didn't we just?
And look how well that worked for everybody. Yeah. So
we'll save that for someone else's podcast.
So the collective culture of women was when a woman was birthing, she would call in her gossips. And being a gossip, so a gossip was a family member or a close friend. And it was a bit like a wedding. You'd be a bit pissed off if you weren't invited to be a gossip at your friend's birth.
I love that.
And the...
I'm not the bridesmaid. She had someone else.
What's wrong with me?
Yeah. Oh, God, do I look good in this dress? Will it be fine for the birth?
And they were actually called God Sibs because their purpose was to witness the birth, kind of in for the church.
For God, the goddess.
Well, no, for God. God, who was at that point a man. God. Yeah, for the church, God. So that's where God Sibs. So they were God's sibling. But it turned into gossip because...
Oh, God's sibling.
Turned into gossip because of what went on. So then they would attend and the midwife would attend. Now... we've got a really romantic idea about what midwifery is, which I think is important to look at in terms of traditional midwifery. So I'm going to go off on a tangent now, you know, like this is what I do. Yeah,
we do.
So midwifery probably came around early on. I'm going way back to the kind of God vulvas on caves time.
Oh, my favorite era.
In that era when Katie was painting gold vulvas on caves.
I was totes there.
Shamans would have been called to difficult births because the idea of danger in birth, because birth has always been dangerous to a certain extent, but the idea was that danger came from kind of spiritual unease, like, you know, you'd attracted in a bad spirit or the environment wasn't right. So if there was a complicated birth happening, a shaman would be called. Now, shamans were women as well. There was men and women were shamans, and they would enact ritual practices that would safeguard the mother and baby. So that's probably where the origins of midwifery started, was that these were experts at managing spirits who were called in for complicated births. And that carried on through the centuries, and that became the wise woman. So the wise woman would be attending a birth, not because she had the skills of attending normal physiological birth, because that belonged to all women. Every woman, it was part of being a woman, was you attended births, you saw births, you knew how to care for a woman during birth, how to nurture her, how to, you know, hold that time after the birth for her and the baby. It wasn't a special skill.
So a bit like a doula now in terms of, you know, a support person, but someone who has more experience in terms of, you know, if you think about it, they would have been witnessing this as children, watching their mothers, their sisters, their aunties, and then that just becomes part of being a skill of support throughout your life. And that's what is expected, and that's part of living in this cultural this type of society.
It's about being with women while they're birthing. And midwifery, the wise woman of the time, who was also the midwife, really was invited to birth for her special skills. So that would be, you know, her ability to know how to manage a complication, to be able to advise on the correct way to, you know, do certain things. So in some senses, they were working more like the obstetrician in that. So when the gossips came to the birth and the midwife came to the birth, the gossips did a lot of that emotional, physical support of the woman. And the midwife, kind of the term used was overseeing. That's kind of what the term was used in those days. She oversaw the birth, which meant that she kind of made sure everybody was doing the right thing and that the rituals were respected. You know, so for in some parts of the world, everything had to be closed off, including keyholes had to be closed. So depending on where the woman was birthing, there were particular rituals that needed to be enacted, and the midwife would make sure that they happened. And the midwife would make sure that she would identify if things were becoming abnormal, and she'd be able to manage that with herbs and, you know, whatever she brought with her. So there was a really strong relationship, and it was very clear lines of roles and responsibilities within that. It was the mother's job to birth her baby. It was the gossip's job to support her physically and emotionally, and particularly in the postnatal period. There's all kinds of kind of ritualized caring for the woman in that postnatal period. So it was the midwife's job to be there, oversee what was happening in terms of making sure the woman was supported, and that if any complications arose, she would use her expertise to manage those. And the midwife was held accountable And midwives have always been held accountable to society and to the community for their practice. And in the Middle Ages, the midwife was held accountable by the church. So in order, you know, they would have to report to the church in terms of, say, yes, this, you know, the baby was born and it was this woman's baby. They would also be involved in the churching of the woman after the lying in period. So they did have a kind of role that was in some ways, you know, being accountable to society and the religion and the state, although licensing midwives was interesting because they resisted it and it didn't really work for a long time. So this collective culture of women was sustained. And during that time, it was women being together in a home, and men were actually kicked out of their homes. Men were responsible often for doing the nidgeting, which was when the woman was in early labor, they'd have to go knock on the doors and get the gossips up and out and call on the midwife. So that was called nidgeting.
Why did they call it nidgeting?
I don't know.
No, it sounds like fidgeting. And I'm just wondering if it stems from that, like, because they're just like, what the hell can I do? Oh, God. Because, you know, you get that kind of sense of feeling like, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm fidgeting around. Nidgeting. I love it.
Okay. So this is a scene where the man is going out to nidget, and it says, when the time draws near of her lying down, then he must trudge to bid gossips. As such you will appoint, or else all the fat is in the fire. You know.
I don't get it. I don't get why the fat's in the fire. What? Was she cooking sausages and she went into labour? And then he had to waste them or something. Sorry. No, I just love the fact that I don't understand the quote.
Well, then nobody else will.
I love it. It's brilliant.
So there was resistance is what I'm saying. And there was attempts to control and to regulate gossips, which is why where the word gossip comes from is because these women would get together and they would probably be drinking quite a bit, especially in the postnatal time. And there would be no men allowed in that area. And they would often be talking about their menfolk and not doing their housework. So there was a lot of concern about this in the communities. And,
sounds brilliant to be a gossip. I definitely go for that job. Making vulvas, being a gossip. I think I've been there. Definitely.
All women would have been gossips because we would have all been going to our friends' births and having merriment and joy.
Well, it's what we do now, hopefully, but not during the birth so much. I mean, as a midwife, I wouldn't want to be on the gin. Maybe afterwards.
Most of the drinking and celebrations took place in the postnatal period because the gossips would still attend the woman's home to look after her and, you know, the baby and do her housework. But I think a fair bit of drinking happened as well. So there was concern.
Yeah, I was going to say, look after her in inverted commas as they lie on the sofa, four gins deep.
So shall I read a little poem that was published about gossips in 1603?
Yeah, I love this poem. Please read it for us, Rachel.
Called Tittle Tattle. So the poem says, at childbirth when the gossips meet, find stories we are told. And if they get a cup too much, their tongues they cannot hold. Then gossips all a warning take. Pray cease your tongues to rattle. Go knit and sew and brew and bake and leave off tittle tattle.
Was this written by a man or
a
woman?
Yeah, of course it was written by a man. But it just gives some it gives some indication of how the collective culture of women was getting backlash even then. And this was before medicalization. So, you know, that kind of set the scene for medicalization, which was built on the religion and philosophy of the time that had evolved, you know, way, way back, thousands of years, that women were dirty, malfunctioning versions of men, and that women's primary role was to reproduce. And then alongside that came this development of technology that could save babies' lives, the forceps in particular, but they were only allowed to be used by men. And men started attending births to rescue babies initially, but then rich women would invite men to attend their births just in case. And we still see that, don't we? We have the just in case still happening today.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the danger that previously was thought to arise from kind of the physical and spiritual environment shifted to be about coming from the woman's body, and that these new technologies and science could really rescue and save women and their babies from the dangers of the woman's body during birth. And the body was seen as a machine. That was another big shift in thinking as men started to study how the body works. It was very mechanistic, and we still see that kind of separate mechanistic thinking. Because whenever cultures, the way we look at things is through what's happening at the time. And at that time, machines were a big thing. So bodies were seen as machines. We nowadays, you listen to people talk about physiology, they'll talk about computers. You know, we download things and we talk about our brain as if it's some kind of computer. So we reflect.
That's really interesting. That is really interesting because, yes, it was in the industrialized period, in particularly in that early sort of mid 1800s. And we see those changes. Women had to go and work in factories. I mean, in terms of lactation, which we'll come on to, that's when there was a huge change as well in terms of breastfeeding and what women were able to do. But I've never really thought about it in terms of the language we use. And you're right, we download things, our brains are, you know, we're, I don't know, user experience. I can't even think of computer words, but you're totally right. I just think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, so that was the ideas, and that made sense to everybody at that time, was that, so you know, so the women's bodies were conceptualized as pistons when they were pushing the baby. It was like fascinating, and we'll talk about this in another podcast when we look at topics, but the way in which topics were explored was, you know, as if it was a machine that was expelling a fetus. In fact, that was actually the terms used by one obstetrician to describe the birth process. So that's that understanding of birth was evolving. At the same time, we were losing the gossips because they were working in factories. So women couldn't just attend births like as gossips because women started to work outside the home. And birth moved into hospital. And kind of the rest, as they say, is fairly recent history. You know, it's only really in the last 100 years that we've had whole-scale birthing in hospital in the West. And all of our understanding of birth evolved from that. So, you know, it evolved from midwifery becoming nursing as well, because midwifery moved from the community into hospitals, from an autonomous profession to a branch of nursing. And while midwives had previously been accountable to community and to society and to religion, they were now actually held accountable to medicine. And we still are held accountable to medicine, even though we're registered as midwives. You know, who sits on our boards? Who regulates our practice? It's still medicine. And this was all before evidence-based practice, because evidence-based medicine didn't come in until the 70s, and not into maternity care until the 90s. So it's really very recent that we've had this idea of, you know, evidence-based practice. And I'm saying an idea because it's still not a reality, because actually practice is still culturally based. And that's why when people say, well, we've got all this evidence that says this thing, it's like, well, it's not going to happen because it doesn't align with the culture. The system isn't broken. You know, people talk about the maternity system being broken. It's not. It's absolutely perfectly reflecting what it evolved from.
I think that's a really, really important point to make. And what you've just been talking about throughout history, it's about the cultural practices of the time, and how they reflect on what we're doing with lots of things within within health, within how we care for people. And yeah, exactly what we're doing now. It's, yes, there might be the evidence, but culturally what's been going on, and how many places and how many times do we hear, but this is how we've always done it, or this is how it's done here, or this is what women want. I know that's thrown in, you know, back in terms of, I've had many discussions trying to extend the length of, say, a prenatal class for women on feeding and on postnatal issues. You know, you're given, so to speak, 2 hours to teach about everything to do with the postnatal aspect and breastfeeding, and you're given an allocated time slot of maybe 6 hours to talk about birth. And what is always has always been told to me when I've tried to allocate for longer time is, but women don't want this. This is not culturally what women want. And I think we as health professionals and we as society almost make the decisions for the women. And it's very difficult to get out of that. That's from my perspective. I don't know if you feel if that's going along with what you're seeing.
Oh, we do a lot of women blaming and saying, well, women want this and women want that. And it's like, well, but yes, maybe they do. But where is that coming from? And how much of that is actually to do with the messages we're transmitting to them and the systems that have been built up and then the belief systems that have underpinned those? And, you know, it's like women's understanding of birth is often underpinned by the same things that health professionals are, which has not changed since the 1900s. And, you know, we still plot labor on a graph because we're still thinking mechanics.
Yep.
You know, we still think that the body is a machine that can be plotted onto a graph and we can make it more efficient by the use of technology. And that's what underpins the increase in inductions, the increase in augmentation. All of those interventions are based on that belief that the body can be mapped onto a nice, neat graph and that we can manage it in a kind of really objective way, which doesn't actually fit with individual women in their bodies. And what we've got to remember is that modern day practitioners, myself included, we learned, you know, when we did our degree, our knowledge was from textbooks and yes, research and practices, because most of what you learn is from what you actually see. And if we've got from the 1900s, you know, women were in the West, women were restrained on delivery tables, actually had straps to strap the woman down on. They had twilight sleep and their babies were removed by obstetricians with episiotomy routine and instruments. And midwives then learned from that. You know, I was talking to a midwife, I was writing about episiotomy in my book, who trained in the 1970s in England. And she was taught that you do an episiotomy for every first baby and then you do one for every woman who's had one. Mm-hmm. So that's every other, but you know.
Yeah.
And that. And then by the 90s,
and that's everyone.
And by the 90s, when we trained, luckily, there'd been research showing that, you know, that's not a good idea, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we weren't taught that. So there was a shift in practice, but we were able to see that. And if you look at textbooks of today, they're still, I was just looking at one of my recent textbooks, and it's still a torso on a bed, on its back, with a baby, this is a drawing, with hands pulling the baby out. So if you're learning, so you learn that from the textbook, then you go into a lab and there's a torso, you know, a model that costs thousands of dollars or pounds or whatever with a baby in it. And then you learn the techniques of pulling the baby out of the torso. So then how are you then meant to go into a birth room and care for a woman who's actually pushing her own baby out of her own vagina without anybody's hands there? It's just...
And she's moving and she wants to change position and she wants to do things that, oh, I've not seen this before. So then as the health professional or the care provider, you then have anxiety and fear because you don't feel like I've been trained in this. Is this safe? So a lot of, I think what happens with us is through fear of keeping the mother and baby safe, of being the, in quotes, expert and the person who's meant to hold this safe space, but also having that as a midwife, you know, this knowledge that you are a support person, you are meant to be with woman, you're meant to be following her lead and her guidance. But, you know, if she's suddenly jumping up and going around the room and getting in all to these different positions, this is like, oh, what do I do here? I'm not sure I've seen it. I have a really vivid memory of being a very newly qualified midwife, just moved to London. And I had a woman who, I think she was from Somalia. She spoke very little English. She came in really active, strong labor. And she literally danced around the room. She got on top of the chair. She squatted standing on the chair. She was up on the bed. Then she was trying to climb on the toilet. It was an incredible dance of which I was frightened. I had fear and anxiety because I really was like, I've never seen this before. And at that point, I didn't know how to handle it, so to speak. I wasn't sure. But then I tried my best to stand back. And, you know, this is a long time ago, but she birthed that baby pretty darn quickly. And at that point, she just got on the bed and squatted. And that was her preferred position. And the thing is, she was there with her sister and her sister was not fazed at all. So that calmed my response down, but it was something I had never witnessed before. It was a few months out of training. But my goodness, her body was obviously moving that baby down and shifting it into the right place. And she birthed beautifully, easily, and had a glorious birth that I will never, ever forget because it was just the most unusual dance method I had ever seen in my life. And a lot of hollering and sort of music and unusual noises as well that I'd also hadn't seen where I'd trained. And it was a real turning point. It was fantastic for me to witness. So, yeah.
I think one of the things blocking us is, again, it goes back to that, you know, as midwives, we're very much taught that, again, danger and risk arise from the woman, that we need to be in control. You know, you hear the word conduct the birth, deliver the baby, that we are accountable for the safety of the mother and baby, and they're really dangerous. So that's where our practice is built. So to, and this is why I actually did my PhD, was that we were taught to do all this stuff to women when they were birthing, control the delivery, you know, coach the pushing. And I really started to question
yes,
that.
Yes.
And the more I backed off and didn't do things, and do you know what? Babies came out of women's vaginas better without me doing all the things I've been taught to do. And do you know what? Women's babies weren't dangerous. And maybe the things I was doing to the woman were dangerous, that really got me back into the looking at what it is we do and why we do it. And it's,
but were you scared? Were you scared to take that back seat? Because I know I was, and I actually followed very much by speaking to you. You gave me the insights, you gave me the knowledge and the confidence, I have to admit, definitely, from following your lead, from them reading stuff that you had told me about. And again, looking up to you as like this big sister and knowledgeable other. But it was scary to pull back. I was really lucky that I went into an environment where I actually had midwives who were very much following this method already, but they were almost an anomaly. It's great when you actually need to use that word within our sphere of practice and you can't say it. They were an anomaly, almost. And they taught me. I had experiences with midwives who would say, stand back and watch, Katie. And we were lucky we were in a hospital that there was two midwives that would always go in with the woman, definitely towards the end of birth. But where we had trained, we were very much, it was, you have to be the sole midwife on your own. And I can remember going down to London in this smaller hospital. And after the first few births that I had been at, I would come out and say, oh, Mrs. So-and-so has given birth and everything's fine. And they would say to me, gosh, that must have been a quick birth. And I'd be like, yep. And then I didn't realize until a few weeks later that at every birth, they had two midwives there, and from as early on as possible. And it was just a joy to behold, because then you would learn from other people's practices. I started to really learn from some really good, experienced midwives who taught me to really stand back. But if I hadn't have had that, I would still be going in with this kind of fear of, I need to manage the birth. I need to be present. I need to be doing something, because that's what I am. I'm the midwife. I'm there to control it, to make sure it goes well. And it wasn't so much about only listening to the woman's body. And I mean, my experience in the birthing world or the birthing unit was fairly short-lived, and I moved into different fields. But it was quite hard to take a stand back and take a different look at your training. And I would imagine if other midwives around you are still following that route, it must be quite difficult. Did you find it difficult to pull back, or were you just thinking, you know, I've got this research, I've got this evidence, I've got this history, I can do this? Or how did you approach that?
No, I think I actually benefited from not having this, because as you know, in the UK, we didn't have a second midwife in the room. So you were kind of on your own in the room with the woman and her partner and whoever else she'd invited to the birth. And you didn't leave the room until you went out, you know, to do the tick on the board. And I guess, you know, the more I thought about it and the more I read, and I didn't go straight in and go, I'm not going to do anything. I just backed off. So I stopped telling women to push, stopped telling multips to push. So that's women not having their first baby. And do you know what? Babies easy come out of women who've had babies before. So then I started not telling women having their first babies to push. And do you know what? They still push their babies out without any instruction. I stopped putting my hands on when babies came out. I just did it in little steps backwards, which then gave me confidence. And really the women taught me. You know, I had to just trust them and, and just kind of reframe what my role is here from that kind of egoic cape wearing, I'm the expert here, and back to that real traditional midwifery, which is actually, no, you're the expert here. My job here is to kind of nurture you, care for you while you do birth your baby, and manage anything if it happens. You know, if you have a hemorrhage, I'll sort that out. But really, you're more likely to have a hemorrhage if I'm doing things. And when I was in private practice in particular, you know, I was actually scared of doing things. You know, intervention to me, by the time I was in private practice, I understood that what I did to a woman was a risk. And particularly a woman
really interesting.
Yeah, and a woman at a home birth, you are the only person there to manage the risk, you know, or you or a or the you know, and another midwife. We often just worked as a single midwife initially until rules came in. So if anything happened, I couldn't hit a buzzer on a wall and get everybody to come and help me with a hemorrhage. So I would do everything I possibly could to eliminate risk from the environment, and that wasn't the woman wasn't the risk. It was me distracting her when she was, you know, interacting with her baby after birth. That would cause the hemorrhage. It was, you know, someone's phone going off or me turning on lights. Or so I started to see what I did as an intervention, which just completely shifted my practice even more. So I guess when you're saying, you know, was I worried? I guess, yeah, I was initially, because we were taught to be the hero and that we have to conduct and deliver. But I started to doubt that and just try a different way and look at the research and support myself with caring for women throughout the whole thing and not just seeing that little like segment, you know, the birth, but seeing them postnatally and going, wow, that woman recovered so much better and her experience of birth was so much better because I just kept out of the way. That also really reinforced to me that, you know, just Rachel, you need to sort yourself out, tuck your ego away and keep out of it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we all go in with the best intentions as midwives, and no one's going in trying to do harm at all. And actually, as a midwife in particular, you're there, you want to be with women, but sometimes we don't actually know that we're doing or we're causing harm because we're following what we've been taught. We're following what the elder, wiser women, midwives around us perhaps are showing us or teaching us or talking about. And that then depends again on the culture. Look, you know, my move from one tertiary unit to a small unit, and I had a completely different experience that made me become much more thinking about what I'm doing, hands off, also very similar, allowing things to just happen, but being very aware of being mindful of anything cropping up where I need more support, but having an environment that allowed that to happen, having older, wiser midwives who were very skilled in home birth and then brought that intuition or brought that thought process into the birthing room. And, you know, just simple things like I can remember being a young, new midwife and there was an old midwife. She wasn't there very long because she was about to retire, but she just had this beautiful nature about her and just showing me things that no one had ever had time for in my learnings as a student midwife in a big tertiary unit. And this mother who's on all fours and showing me parts of the back and how the cervix. What's the bottom of the back called?
Well, rhombus of Michaelis, but that's probably named after a man. So
I'm good, aren't I? Good with my birthing knowledge. But I mean, it's just showing me parts of the woman's body that's moving. And we just stood or we sat watching her and supporting her. And we were in this beautiful, quiet, dark environment, but in a hospital. And I just remember learning so much. I used to love it when I'd be on shift with her and I could get her to come in at the end of birth or be the second midwife to her because I would watch her. On the other reverse side of the coin, having the second midwife, there was times when, of course, you'd have a more senior midwife who would then be directing me to tell this woman to push. And I can remember, you know, fingers in the perineum, push down here, come on, good girl, all of this type of stuff, which I recoiled at. You know, I think of it differently now, but at the time I just recoiled because it felt wrong and I didn't like it and I didn't want to call someone that. But I was often, as a student midwife, I was not told off, that's not the right word, but I was told there was a report back to the university lecturer that I needed to be more directive in when I did active pushing with women. I needed to be more vocal. And, you know, I'm quite a loud person and I can have a big personality, but in birth, I never felt that helped. It felt wrong, but I couldn't sort of extrapolate my thoughts as to why it felt wrong. And so what I found that I was doing when I had two people in the birthing room was that there was practices which I thought, I will never, ever do this to a woman. And there was practices which I thought, I am so grateful to have learned this. So a different experience to you. And unfortunately, you know, there are times when you do see things that you really think, I will never, ever do this to a woman. But unfortunately, at the time, you don't feel strong enough to stand up for that. And I don't think that's just with midwives. It's also with the obstetricians. And we have this problem where we don't necessarily find our voice. And I think that's time that will come at another podcast where we talk about how we can be strong as an advocate for the woman. Because that's a minefield and it can be a huge challenge, particularly when you're a new midwife, to have that strength of voice. But yeah.
Well, we're socialized as women to not be awkward and difficult and to not challenge authority.
Know your place, woman.
Yeah, which I've never been very good at. And then as student midwives and new midwives, you're groomed to meet the needs of the institution. And at the same time, the women are groomed to, you know, through the antenatal period, to see us as experts and to kind of give their bodies over to the experts in order to be safe. And so when they're saying, you know, oh, women want that because we've groomed them to believe that if they don't have that, then they're not going to be safe because they can't trust themselves and their bodies and their babies because we are the experts. And, you know, it's how we shift that in a system that's evolved from that history and is still so much, you know, it's still really embedded in there. And we're starting to see, we're now at the situation where we've got all of this research evidence supporting the physiology and the not doing things to women. Yes, we're getting research that, you know, we'll talk about in other podcasts that can be interpreted to support intervention because of the way in which it's conducted and then translated, the findings translated. But we've got all of this research to support the promotion and support of physiology and respectful maternity care. We've got World Health Organization saying, don't tell women to push. We need to have respectful maternity care. You know, so at a big picture thing about how we need to respect women, and at a small picture thing of, you know, don't do episiotomies, don't tell women to push, don't do these things. And yet it still carries on. And we're getting almost a kickback from the institutions that are then looking at guidelines that say, you know, for example, in Queensland, our normal birth guidelines are actually pretty good in terms of respecting women and saying that there isn't any evidence to support this, that and the other. And, you know, don't tell women to push, support them to follow their own bodies. And yet we then have workplace directives that tell midwives that they've got to have their hands on the perineum, that they've got to do these things. And then the midwives, if they don't do those things, they've got team leaders watching them, so they'll, you know, be reprimanded. And if there's a bad outcome, even though it's got nothing to do with whether they had the hands on the woman or not, they will be held accountable. And so there's a huge amount of fear because of the sense of responsibility and accountability. And, you know, I think this is going to be a whole podcast in itself because it's huge. And I think that's the main thing midwives contact me about and students is how to navigate what the system that we've got now.
I think that's probably a great place for us to wrap up on this episode. We've really done the whistle stop tour of, you know, modern birth and the practices and the history of, or the her story of women. And it's brought us back to current day. So I think this has been such a great time talking to you through this because you have such a knowledge. And I know there's many people out there with this absolute awesome knowledge. And it absolutely fascinates me. I'm really relatively new to really this history of us as women. the more I think we read, the more knowledge we have, the more we can spread this message of, you know, there's a reason why we're doing what we do now. And I think this has been a really fabulous episode to kind of start off our podcast and really of what we will be talking about over the next episodes. And hopefully you will join us, because this is our passion. This is where our hearts and our minds lie. And we are really looking forward to some of the guests that we will be having on the podcast and some of the topics that we will be going through. So stay tuned for the next episodes and we will see you there. I'm also going to ask you a very little favor. Please like us, please subscribe, and if you'd be ever so kind, please pop us a comment in the podcast app that you're listening to, and we will see you next episode on the Midwife's Cauldron podcast. And go on, I'll let you have a few bloopers again this episode. I think this is going to be a habit. With the way we record.
So there's a French satire written on childbirth, which includes a scene in which a man laments that he is no longer the master of his home. So this is what was going on when women were in labour in early postnatal time. And this was about him being sent out to kind of knock on the doors and to nudge it to get the gossips and the midwife there. And in this satire, it says, "When the time draws near of her lying down, then must he trudge to bid bishops." Oh.
Must he trudge to bid bishops? What?
Bang.
Wait.
Bang.
No, I'm keeping it. I'm keeping that. What are you talking about?
Oh, shut up. Right, shush. It? Let me do it again. Stop. Bang.
Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies, and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.